Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. I want to welcome you to episode 4 of Remarvel, where I remove current year from what I hold dear, which is a neat little tagline that rhymes, but weird thing, as soon as I come up with it, I wind up buying a current year book. You know, I've been so invested again in these old Marvel books here that I actually went out. I decided that, you know, without question, I was ready to be hurt again. So I went out and I bought the latest X-Men number 1 from, I think it was Jonathan Hickman and Lionel Yu. The newest one, which doesn't have Uncanny in the title, but is still carrying on with the Uncanny Legacy numbering, I think? I don't know. I couldn't even pretend to understand what Marvel's thinking here with the voodoo math and the weird numbering. I'm trying my best to dissociate from that, you know, like not focus on that so much because that I'm a very simple man. That does inhibit my appreciation for the product in a way. So if I'm able to maybe detach myself from that, I might find myself enjoying it, you know, quite a bit more. But there it is. I actually spent $5 on an X-Men comic book, a current year, current month, current week X-Men book. I haven't gotten to read it yet, is the thing. I read, like, the first 5 or 6 pages. What I saw, I thought was pretty cool. Of course, I'm reading it in a vacuum. I don't know anything that came before it. I didn't read all those, you know, something of X, powers of X, heroes of X, whatever those things were, those miniseries that led up to this. I didn't read any of that, mostly because they were just, it felt so labyrinthine, and you know, being a guy who's read X-Men for over 30 years now, it's weird to be in a position where something going on in the X-books is labyrinthine to me, you know? I feel like a complete outsider, which, you know, is fair, as I have been an outsider from the Marvel books for quite a while at this point. But I didn't jump in on those because, frankly, I hadn't started this project yet, and I figured I was just going to let yet another relaunch pass me by. So I did pick up the first issue, like I said, read the first few pages because I just didn't have the time to get through the entire thing this week. Thought it was okay for what it was. I am looking forward to getting through the rest of it. You know, I'm not the biggest Hickman fan. To be blunt, I find him to be a perfectly suitable cure for insomnia most of the time. I read through his Fantastic Four, I followed along, bought it as it was coming out, and you know, there's a lot of high-level concepts, but to me, I think you need to have a little bit more than that. You know, just being able to, like, raise an eyebrow and be like, oh, that's clever. That's not enough for me. I need there to be actual story there, too, which, you know, hey, everything's an opinion. So, I mean, I know that I'm in the minority of not enjoying the Fantastic Four run. His Avengers run, also, I felt like I was watching the same scene over and over again where it'd be Captain America and Iron Man saying, the Avengers need to get bigger, need to get bigger, need to get bigger, like every single issue. And then they introduced like those antler-headed aliens, and it was just a slog for me. So, and then Secret Wars was, not my favorite. So I was a little more than trepidatious when it came to his taking over the X-Men. But like I said, I read about 5 or 6 pages. Thought it was good. Don't know how it ended up. I'm hearing a lot of good things about it. A lot of folks who, I shared an image of me buying the book. And a lot of people chimed in that, you know, that this is a good run. This is a good run. So I am looking forward to it. I did throw the second issue on my DCBS order. So that will be coming. Maybe next week I'll talk a little bit about it if I do get the opportunity to read the whole thing. It's just been a nutty few weeks here at the palatial Chris State. Last week was finals for one class. This week is starting a brand new class, so it's a lot of weird time management trying to adjust and still get family stuff done. I put out 3 episodes last week. Still doing the blog daily, so it's time is a commodity at this point. So it's a little tougher for me to fit in any kind of fun reading. Add to that I spent much of last week back in New York City. Just not a whole lot of time to do to do much. I probably could have brought the comic with me, which probably would have been smart, because I'd have been a captive audience on the plane for several hours. But unfortunately, I didn't even think of it. But I will hopefully be able to share my thoughts if you know, anyone cares to hear my thoughts over the next couple weeks. I also would like to do a little bit of homework on all the stuff that led to the new the new launch. I hear that it changes a lot of the way that the mutants are looked at or perceived. And, I'm always up to learn a little bit more about something, so I don't just come off complaining about something that I didn't do the due diligence on, you know. While sort of on the subject of my trip back to New York, I suppose I could share a little bit of that with you. This is normally something that I would just bore friends with, but joke's on you. I don't really have many of those, so here we go. There's a little bit of comics in this. We stayed in Midtown Manhattan, just probably a maybe 10-minute walk away from Midtown Comics, the Grand Central Station location, and I did take a walk there my first morning, because the wife was in meetings, and I was left to my own devices, and that's never good for me, because I'm not good at making decisions and stuff, so it's basically just me wandering. My only real destination the whole trip was I wanted to see the WPIX building, because our hotel was like three doors down from it, and I thought it'd be cool to see Channel 11's building. Just being a New York kid, it was important to me. It was wildly underwhelming, but I'm glad I saw it. I took a picture of it. I shared it with a few folks who would understand the importance of Channel 11, especially this month during Shocktober, you know. But I kept walking after popping into my favorite hole-in-the-wall coffee shop, Starbucks. You probably never heard of it. It's a very small place. That's another thing that's kind of disappointing. I was expecting a lot more hole-in-the-wall sort of stuff, and there really wasn't as much. Granted, I'm not terribly familiar with Manhattan. Like Jim from The Office said, he went to Manhattan every time his school went on a class trip there. And that's basically all the times I went to Manhattan, because I grew up in Brooklyn, Staten Island, and Long Island. So Manhattan was a destination. You'd go there because your fifth grade teacher was dragging you to see Cats, or which we did, which was very strange, being in fifth grade and having a field trip to go see Cats at the Winter Garden Theater. But, you'd do the Rockettes, you'd do the Christmas tree lighting. We live in Staten Island, you take the ferry over to Battery Park, stuff like that. But I never really wandered the streets of Manhattan, at least at any, at any great length. We'd sneak in on occasion when I lived in Long Island. We'd hop on the LIE and head out to Penn Station when we had an extra, $5 or $6 for the trip in our pockets. But, didn't really get too far, because usually the $6 was all we had in our pockets, and we didn't really have any spending money. So it was just let's walk a couple blocks, hop back on the train, and go home. So left to my own devices, what is a guy like me going to do? I don't have very many interests. I'm not a very interesting guy. So, I got to look up a comic book store. And I knew Midtown was somewhere in the area. So got the directions, walked to Midtown, and, it was underwhelming. Very underwhelming. I walked up the flight of stairs to get there, and what I saw was a comic book store. I mean, can't fault it for being what it advertises itself to be, but I was expecting more. And granted, there were other locations, other Midtown locations in the city, but this one was just, had, half the store was dedicated to Funko Pops, two-thirds of the wall was dedicated to variant covers, so it's basically just a comic book store, and I didn't buy anything, because, most of all, I didn't want to get anything crushed in my luggage. I did see a lot of the X-Men number ones there, and I was tempted to buy it, but I'm like, I can't double dip already. That's just silly. I really probably shouldn't have bought it before I left to go on vacation. I should have just bought it there. I would have been able to get the actual, normal cover, too. I wound up getting a variant, because the shop I went to here was sold out of the regular cover, which is, a good thing and a bad thing. I like the fact that people are more drawn to the main cover than these ridiculous variants, but at the same time, I was stuck buying one of those ridiculous variants, which kind of sucks. I did manage to buy the least offensive one. It's got like Cyclops, Jean Grey, and Wolverine popping out of a cake, which, sad to say, that was the least offensive variant at the store when I went. So yeah, from Midtown, I took a walk up to Rockefeller Center and stopped in at the Nintendo store, which I didn't even know was a thing that existed. So that was pretty neat to find. Really cool stuff to see there. A lot of cool statues, and there's a big Mario on a flagpole there. It's a lot of really cool stuff. Probably the coolest thing I saw there, though, was the... If you grew up with Nintendo Power, you're probably familiar with this image of a Game Boy that was taken to Operation Desert Storm and got itself tangled in some battle. It was battle damaged, and it still plays. So it's this like charred out Game Boy, and it still plays Tetris. And they put a picture of that in Nintendo Power like 100 years ago, and they still have the thing. At the Nintendo store in Manhattan, and it's still playing Tetris. So I thought that was really, really cool. It's not something I'd thought of in years. And then I, you know, like came back and I saw it, and suddenly I was, you know, like 10 years old again. It's like, wow, that is pretty cool. So I felt like I was seeing a little bit of my childhood that I didn't realize that I wanted to see. So that was pretty cool. My main takeaway from these two stores was that, you know, there's a lot of specialness gone since the world has become so much smaller with the internet. Exclusivity is just not something that really exists anymore so much. You know, you think about going somewhere and getting something that you can only get there. You know, I went to Midtown. It's the, you know, one of the bigger comic stores that chains in the country, you know, and I figured maybe there'd be something I can get that I couldn't get anywhere else. And no, it's all the same stuff that we can get anywhere. And now with the internet, if I actually wanted a, you know, Midtown variant, I could buy it online. It's not like I need, you know, it's not like been there, done that, got the t-shirt, because you could just get the t-shirt. You could skip the first part. Same with the Nintendo store. I'm like, hey, maybe there's like a, and it's going to sound hypocritical, maybe there's like a game with like an exclusive, you know, cover, you know, maybe just something that says, hey, I was here. And really, just no. They had t-shirts that, you know, I could get online. So it's nothing special about it. Which really, I'm not a very worldly guy. I've mentioned time and again. I don't travel very often. But I feel like those little niceties are missing now. It's like there is no exclusivity. The specialness and taking a memento, you don't even need to experience the experience in order to have a memento from it. And I think that's kind of too bad. I wonder how future generations are going to, they're not even going to be able to relate to something like that because it's just never been something they had to deal with. I think that takes a little bit of the magic away from traveling, whatever magic there is to traveling in the first place. But that was my main takeaway from going to these two stores. And so slump shouldered, I went to my other, the other thing I wanted, which was food. Because if you ever meet someone from New York, no matter what state you're in, if you're, you know, you could be here in Phoenix and you talk to someone who's from New York, one of the first things they're going to talk about if the subject of back home comes up is the food. And the main food I wanted from my trip back was a bagel. I wanted a bagel. My standing order at a bagel store is poppy seed bagel with butter, not toasted. You know, that's what I get anytime I go to a bagel shop. And so I went to Essa Bagel, which pretty happening place, it turns out. Like I said, I don't know a whole lot about Manhattan. But a lot of people wanted to eat there that day. I was actually online. All I was getting was two bagels and a cup of coffee. And I was online for over 45 minutes. It was pretty ridiculous. And I'm figuring, hey, you know, this is probably a good sign. You know, this is probably the best bagel I've ever had, or at least the best bagel I've had in 20 years. So there I am. I'm online. Finally get to the front. I tell the guy what I want. Of course, they toast the damn thing anyway, which makes the butter melt, which changes the entire consistency of the thing. I like it cold. You know, I like a cold bagel with, you know, big glob of butter in the middle. You know, that's my bagel. I didn't realize this until I was like three blocks away sitting on a bench because there was no way to sit in this restaurant. And I didn't feel like sitting on the curb or on the side of a building. So I kept walking for a bit and sat on a bench a couple blocks down the way. And I open it up, and there, sure enough, Bud is all melted. It's dripping everywhere. It was just a real mess. And I wasn't about to walk back to stand on line again. So I figured, I'll just eat it and deal with it. But it was very underwhelming, which, I mean, I'm using that word a lot. But, you know, it's this weird dissonance. You know, I went, you know, technically I went home, but I didn't see anything familiar because that part of my home was never really my home. And I'm rambling at this point, which you're certainly accustomed to. But it was underwhelming. The wife got out of her meetings and she wanted some pizza, so we did go to Patsy's Pizza, which was really good. First bite was a little underwhelming, but you know, once my taste came back, it was good. Really good stuff. I actually, you know, get cravings for it. I've been getting cravings for it ever since. And she wanted to stop at a hot dog stand. She'd never eaten, you know, from a, you know, street hot dog. Got knishes, you know, all the, you know, the standard street foods, you know. We went to the Magnolia Bakery, had some of the greatest cheesecake I've ever had in my life. Definitely the smoothest cheesecake I've ever had in my life. Really good stuff. But the thing that really made me take pause, and this is going to sound so stupid, Magnolia Bakery is downstairs at Grand Central Station, and on the way up from there, I noticed in, of all places, a damn Rite Aid, they had an end cap full of Entenmann's, which, if you're not familiar with Entenmann's, it's, you know, like the crumb cakes and the cookies and the donuts. It's pastries. It's, you know, boxed pastries, basically. And we don't really have them out here. We do have, like, the donuts are out here, the Entenmann's donuts, and also, like, those to-go cakes, kind of. It's like, they'll be like a cupcake or like a little crumb cake, like, individually wrapped so you could throw it in a school lunch or something. So those are what we can get out here. But what I haven't had in like 20 years are the little chocolate chip cookies. And holy smokes, that just, seeing that, it's like stopped me in my tracks. And had to go into a Rite Aid. And it's weird that that's like the highlight of this trip, was going into a Rite Aid and buying a box of cookies. And the thing of it is, they're not even that great. They kind of, they taste cheap and synthetic, but it's, you know, it's all nostalgia and it's all, I love them just for the fact of what they are. And I actually broke my diet for them. I've long advocated eating healthier and cutting out sugar, but I couldn't pass these up. I figure the next time I have a box of these, I'll probably be, at this rate, I'll probably be like 60. So, you know, I could do a box of these things and not worry. But yeah, I ate that. The entire box, got really bad heartburn, and well, that's about it. I did come home and I was surprised to learn that I didn't gain any weight, which was, I was expecting to come home 10 pounds heavier. That's what happened when we went to the Seattle area over the summer. I did overindulge and came back about 7 pounds heavier than when I left. And I was afraid that I'd come back just as heavy this time, but no, I didn't gain anything. It was probably because I did all that walking, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a nutritionist. Maybe I just got very lucky. It happens from time to time. But with all that nonsense out of the way, I should probably introduce what we're going to be talking about today for this episode of Remarvel. Now, this is kind of piggybacking off of our discussion last week. If you listened last week, I talked about X-Men Volume 2, Number 45. Now, that marked my first official exit from Marvel Comics, or just comics in general, the X-Men in particular. Now, the book we're going to discuss today kind of signifies my return to comic reading, comic buying, and it just feels like the next logical step, and it also facilitates a little bit of a story that, you know, and I apologize if this is insanely boring. I assume it is, but I do want to thank you all the same for humoring a rambling idiot and sticking around. Now, this comes after my family moved from New York to Arizona. And I did talk about our move during an episode of Chris's On Infinite Earths. I never assume people have listened to anything, so I can give you like the very quick and you know, very painless of that. We moved from New York to Arizona a couple days after high school graduation. And at that point, my life's mission became getting back to New York. You know, it was just, I needed to get a job so I could buy a bus ticket, a plane ticket, any which way that I could find a way back to New York, and at which time I would just live there. I would just stay, and everything would work out. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I was smarter back then, but in many more ways, I was dumber back then. I just thought everything was going to fall into place and never really gave, you know, step two, three, four, and five much of a thought. I just had to get back. And so everything I did was in service of finding a job and making enough money to get back. Now, this was a problem because, as I discussed in that episode of Chris's On Infinite Earths, at the time, if I attempted to grow a beard, I would look kind of skeezy and old. But if I was clean-shaven, I looked like I was 12. So it was a really hard balancing act trying to present myself to a fine grocery store establishment or a gas station or wherever I thought might have a job. And so for a long time, I wasn't able to find any sort of gig. And one day a week, I would drive my mother into work. So I would have the car all day so I could, you know, theoretically, you know, expand my circle of potential employment and you know, put in more applications. And this facilitated my first trip to the nearby mall, which I was avoiding like the plague. I was just not feeling going to a mall. First of all, it would like facilitate my first time, the first time I saw people my own age, and I don't think I was ready for that. I don't know if it's like agoraphobia or a peopleophobia or whatever it was, but I didn't want to see people my age, you know. Maybe it was a comparison thing, maybe it was I don't know what the hell it was, but I didn't really want to deal with people high school or college aged at that point. I don't know, maybe it would just further cement, like, my new reality. I don't know what it was. I handled this move very poorly. And if you are interested, I did go into quite a lot of depth about that in a recent Chris's on Infinite Earths that I'll link in the show notes in case anyone wants to suffer through that with me. So anyway, what I did was I went to the mall, and I figured, you know, I could apply at every, you know, pretzel stand, food court, whatever. Because, I mean, there were kids working there. It shouldn't be too hard for me to get a job there. I tell you what, I get into this place, and it's weird walking around a mall by yourself when you're still a kid, you know? Because usually when you're at a mall, you're with a bunch of friends, or at least a couple friends. And to be walking around by myself was very strange. Almost like off-putting, like really, it just felt wrong, you know? But I did get in there, and walking around, I see, of all things, a comic book store. And it was the first comic book store that I actually saw in Arizona. I knew that there were a few because, I mean, Atomic Comics was like the biggie, or one of the biggies, and they would advertise in Wizard. So, I mean, I always knew that there was, relatively a robust comics retail community out here. But I never really sought it out because I wasn't into the comics at that point. But anyway, at the mall, I see a comic shop, and I figure, hey, you know, kill two birds with one stone. I can go in, I can apply for a job, maybe, and also just take a look at what's on the wall. You know, it's been like 2 years at this point that I'd been away, and I was just, maybe I'll just take a look at what they've got. I had a few bucks, you know, burning a hole in my pocket, so might as well check it out. So yeah, I go in, I find out they're not taking applications, and in fact, this very store was out of business the next time I went to the mall. It was a it was like 1997, so like even off the tail end of the speculator bust, so it was not long for the world at this point. So while I'm there, I do take a look at the new release wall, and I didn't pay any attention to DC. I wasn't into DC at the time. I had really no frame of reference for DC outside of the Death of Superman and maybe a little bit of Nightfall at this point. But I looked, and the Marvel books, they all did this like weird banner on top. It said, the world's greatest comics. And my first thought when I saw that was like, wow, that looks kind of cheap. You know, I thought it looked kind of cheesy, like they were, protesting too much or something. It just seemed very weird that they all had this banner. Because when I left, things were still like bombastic, you know. They weren't trying to sell you. Back then, it was just like, they're here, you're gonna buy them, so we don't need to sell you on it. And here, it kind of looked like, I don't know, almost like a vulnerability, You know, like, please buy this book. We promise you'll enjoy it. But I skimmed through and I didn't think anything didn't really jump out at me. I did pick up an issue of X-Men. I think it was X-Men number 74. Had Angel on the cover with Abomination, the Hulk villain. And I grabbed that because I thought it was pretty cool that, you know, the X-Men were fighting a mainstream Marvel villain, which really hadn't been done throughout my tenure as an X-Men reader. Everything was, everything was very, very segregated. You know, Spider-Man would fight his villains, the Avengers would fight theirs, the X-Men would fight theirs, and they really didn't cross the streams all that much. So when I see Abomination on the cover of X-Men, it kind of made me, you know, raise an eyebrow. This is before, of course, you know, the Marvel Universe became just such a melting pot of, you know, everybody is everywhere all the time. So this was a novelty, especially to me, because I hadn't read a whole heck of a lot. I'd only read from like the late 80s on. So this was pretty cool. I'm like, hey, I'll grab this. And immediately my brain starts going a mile a minute again, and it's like, okay, well, I can collect all the X-Men Volume 2 stuff again. You know, I can catch up to that from 45 to 73 that I would have to grab at this point. So I'm like racking my brain, like, okay, I'm trying to figure out figures in my head. It's like, well, they'll probably be like $5 each, so it'll take this amount of time and yada, yada, yada. And then from the corner of my eye, I see a book that I would have never looked at this point. And it was the new issue of X-Force. Now, of the four main X-books, X-Men Uncanny, X-Men X-Factor, and X-Force was the one I liked the least. From Jump Street, I didn't like Cable. I didn't like the more militant nature, especially when they didn't stick the landing of it being like a proactive team. Like the whole purpose of X-Force was that they were going to be proactive, and then it turned out that they were basically just a meaner version of the X-Men who weren't terribly proactive, and plus you had Cable, and I hated Cable at that time. Of course, this is around the time that Joe Casey was writing the Cable ongoing series, which is some of my very favorite Cable stuff, but I didn't know that yet. This was all just me not liking a character and not liking a particular conceit of an ongoing series. But I looked at this cover, and it promised like a new direction, and it looked a lot like an Image book. It didn't look like a standard Marvel book. It didn't look like a superhero book. It featured the team, the younger members of the team, like hitchhiking. And it immediately caught my eye and captured my imagination. And I wondered, you know, what could all this mean? You know, what is this new direction here? And could this be something that I might be interested in? And then I noticed something which was really weird, and that this was an older issue. It was like maybe like 3 or 4 months old at this point, and it was still on the new shelf, you know? And I'm looking and I'm flipping through because, you know, when I stopped buying comics, there was the new shelves and then there was the back issues. And the new shelves only had the newest issue on them. Everything else got bagged, boarded, and upcharged. And here I am, a couple of years later, where there's more of a, like, six-month wall. And it's the first time I ever saw something like that. And so I'm flipping through and I'm seeing, like, subsequent issues of X-Force, you know, like, this was 71, and I mean, like, 72, there were other issues. And it just blew me away, and it made me realize that, you know, maybe buying comics now won't be as expensive as it was back then, where, you know, I might be able to get away with paying cover price for older books, which at the time, you got to remember, this was a very different time. So this was just something that just made me, you know, take notice and made me step back and realize that maybe the bottom did fall out. Maybe I wasn't the only one who walked away, or maybe I wasn't the only one who got fatigued from the gimmicks and the sticker shock and all that kind of stuff. So, and, you know, that's when my mind starts going, you know, several miles a minute. And I'm starting to make, I'm starting to, like, add up all the figures. Like, how can, it's like I was like Rain Man or something. It's like, okay, well, there were like a dozen X-books a month at this point, and I haven't bought them for 2 years. So it's like, okay, that's about 300 issues I need to catch up on. It was just ridiculous. But But I saw this issue of X-Force, and I couldn't resist it, because it was just so different from what I had expected. And because I was just used to this, like, you know, giant guns, Cable's face everywhere. And Cable isn't even in this issue. You know, there are no guns. Or there might be a couple of guns, but there are no big, giant Liefeldian guns. And it just really challenged my perception of what an X-Force book would be. And so I grabbed it and immediately fell in love with this new direction. And it became, which is weird, it became for a short time my favorite X book going on at that time, because it felt like the X-Men books that I had left, you know, where you'd have, you know, the X-Men playing football on Thanksgiving. You know, it was like a family book, and that's not something I ever expected to read in X-Force. I always saw X-Force as, like, Youngblood era Image rather than like Gen 13 era Image, where now it looked a lot more like Gen 13. It was just kids hanging out, growing up. They got powers, but it felt a lot more, I hate to say relatable, but I think that's as good as a descriptor as I can give you. From here, I was all in. You know, I was back. And X-Men 74 ended, and I knew, and it's weird, I knew that number 75 was coming out. And we know the rule of 90s comics, where every 25th issue is something big and bombastic and overpriced and gimmicked up. And I thought, like, this is the dumbest thing in the world for me to jump on at number 74, when 75 is surely going to be, you know, something incredibly overblown. But I don't recall it being. I know it was a little bit thicker than normal, but it didn't have the gimmicked up cover or anything like that. So I think it was a little bit easier a pill to swallow, especially since I knew that I was going to have so many gimmick covers to catch up on, including X-Men number 45, which was the one that slammed the door on my fandom for a little while. But suffice it to say, I'd spend the next couple of years catching up. While trying to keep current, which, you know, it's comics could be a drug, you know. I was buying the issues that I'd missed in my 2 years off. I was staying current with the X books. I was also expanding out into the, you know, the greater Marvel Universe, which, you know, might tell you a thing or two about my saving money for that trip back to New York. It really didn't pan out so good for me, but it also didn't help me in real life either, because I was still, you know, all by my lonesome, not dealing well with a new environment, and really just losing myself in this fantastical, you know, comic universe here, which is probably part of the blame for my my stunted emotional and whatever development that I've had ever since. But with the table set, I figure it's time to finally get into discussing the book we've gathered here today to discuss, and that is X-Force number 71. Now, this had a November 1997 cover date. Story title is Destination : Unknown. Written by John Francis Moore, pencils by Adam Polina, inks by Team X, and I'm guessing that's just a group of inkers and not that team from Wildstorm or whatever. Colors by Marie Javins. Letters by Richard Stalkings and Comic Craft's Emerson Miranda. Separations by Digital Chameleon. Edited by Mark Powers, Bob Harris as the chief. Cover price $1.99. Now this, worth noting here, this is during that time where Marvel had like the gatefold cover kind of, where like you can unfold the cover and on the inside it gives you like a nice quick and dirty catch up of what's been going on, and it gives you a rundown of the characters. Marvel kind of does that as like the front page nowadays, but back then it didn't, you know, occupy an actual story page, which is pretty cool. I like that as a gimmick. I feel like that helped a lot of serve a lot of masters, because it gave us some exposition, and it also allowed for more ads to run, because there was more paper, you know, more ad real estate availability, you know. But it was a cool gimmick, and I really dug it. I still like flipping through those when I see them. But as we enter our story, the X-Force kids are broken down on the side of the road there somewhere in Ohio. Warpath wonders aloud how they got themselves into this mess, and Sunspot reminds him that they all told Cable to stick it and walked out on him. Now, a little bit of background on that. Cable kind of drew a line in the sand. This is during Operation Zero Tolerance, so, like, everybody was out to get the mutants, you know? Cable suggested that the entire team adopt new identities and take the group underground. You know, just go off the grid and just not be who they were. And the X-Force kids are tired of running, they're tired of hiding, and they told him to, you know, shove it. So, Tabitha, Boom Boom, Meltdown, whatever you want to call her, she is playing around under the hood, and I promise that's not a euphemism. As she does this, Danny Moonstar is reading On the Road, because she is incredibly deep. Tabitha proves to be a rather poor mechanic, which, you know, sort of stands to reason, since her main talent is blowing things up anyway. Worth noting, though, she is wearing a t-shirt featuring a mustacheless Captain Crunch, which is very, very weird to look at. After the engine goes boom in her face, Bobby fires up his powers in order to look for a tow truck. Siren warns him to power down because, you know, zero tolerance. Nobody wants to see, you know, mutants anymore. Bobby realizes that Teresa is probably right, and he unsunspots himself. While the team chats, a van pulls up alongside them, and, you know, they pass, this van passes by a billboard advertising Deus Ex Machina, how do you say that word? Deus Ex Machina? Anyway, this billboard says Deus Ex Machina on it, which, this van kind of is the Deus Ex whatever the hell from this ass thing, so, I guess we can rimshot that. The kids hail the van over, and, it's the Mystery Machine. Like totally the Mystery Machine. It's, there are only two members of the Scooby Gang inside, though. One looks like Shaggy. The other looks like Velma or Thelma or whatever the hell her name is, you know, the nerdy one. Danny Moonstar figures it's cool to hop on, so long as these hippies don't force them to listen to the Grateful Dead. And, I remember in high school, a lot of kids were getting into Grateful Dead, and a lot of them were wearing, like, the teddy bear with the ruffle collar shirts, and I never really got into that. I remember hearing a joke with, it's like, what do deadheads say when they run out of drugs? Wow, this music sucks. And I you know, I can't speak to that. I have pretty weird tastes myself. Anyway, after they hop into the hoopty, a news report comes playing over the radio, and it's all zero-tolerance stuff. You know, humanity can't rest until the mutant threat is contained and all that jazz, and this makes the X-Force kids, you know, get a little bit hot under the collar. They get a little bit uncomfortable. Then the hippies turn and look at them and say, this whole thing is bogus. Thelma, Velma, whoever she is, her name is Louise in this comic. She turns to the team and suggests that everybody's got something weird and freaky about them, so maybe that means everybody's a mutant in their own special way, which the X-Force kids are very, very relieved to hear. Now, the hippies drop them off at a gas station where they learn from a mechanic that their carburetor is shot. What's more, it's going to be a day before they can get a new one delivered. Now, while Tabitha deals with the mechanic, an apprentice named Marty tries coming on to Danny Moonstar. He uses all of his best lines, including telling her that she's hot enough to be on MTV. She appreciates that, but she ain't into him that way. Boom Boom, or Meltdown, tells the team that they're sacked for 24 hours, so they probably better try to make the best of it. Teresa walks off alone to go shopping. She hits the shops. Bobby and James walk off together. Proud Star is lamenting the fact that he won't be getting to Nebraska as quickly as he had hoped. You see, he's looking to meet with a fella named Michael Whitecloud, who apparently has all the details on the massacre of James's tribe. Tabby and Danny head off together. The former asks the latter what she thought about that flirty Marty back at the garage. Danny says he wasn't her type, and she also reveals that she's struggling getting close to people since she spent so much time undercover as a member of the Mutant Liberation Front. Oh yeah, she, it's worth noting, she, was part of the Mutant Liberation Front. She was a bad guy for a little while, but they retconned that into being her just being undercover. The Mutant Liberation Front is a group of mutant terrorists. They reported to Strife. I think they reported to other people too, but she was a bad guy is what I'm trying to say. Now our scene shifts to the Weller Clinic in Langley, Virginia. Here we see Domino, and she's having some target practice. She's throwing scalpels at diagrams of anatomy. And it's pretty neat here. They have all the scalpels hitting vital organs because it's like a see-through body. It's a neat little touch. Now, she is interrupted by a Dr. Rebecca Schuyler. She's a woman that Domino had rescued years before. And we find out that Domino is here for testing because during the Zero Tolerance mess, she had been abducted and implanted with something by a Prime Sentinel. The doc reveals that this device was implanted right at the base of her skull, and to remove it would leave Domino paralyzed. Now, that's a bummer for plenty of reasons, one of which has to do with Domino's ability to use her powers. So she is kind of grounded in as far as using her extraordinary powers at this point. We jump back to Ohio, more specifically Flo's Diner. I guess every town has a Flo's Diner in it. And the kids have come together for a bite to eat. We learn that Danny is a vegetarian because, well, there had to be one. Bobby hands over his credit card to pay for the meal, which is weird to them because they're used to Cable or Professor X footing the bill, which I like that touch. It's cool, though, because Bobby DaCosta is loaded. Only problem, his card is refused and summarily cut into pieces. Danny winds up covering lunch because she still has a little bit of cash left from her time with the MLF. Later on, Bobby calls the credit card company and he finds out that his family is being sued, and as such, all of their funds are frozen. So, there goes the X-Force safety net. There is no more money. Once Danny Moonstar's little purse dries up, they're done. Siren wonders what might happen if they go completely broke. Are they going to have to crawl back to the X-Men, or are the X-Men going to accept them? I mean, how do you explain yourself? Especially, you know, they're of that age where optics are very important, and sometimes it's more important to be right than to be comfortable, so who knows. Now, speaking of the X-Men, we swap scenes over to Salem Center, New York, where Deadpool is knocking on Teresa's old window. He imagines her throwing herself at him because, he's got a thing for her. He's shocked to find her room completely empty, though. Now, it looks like this scene was included only to remind X-Force readers that Deadpool actually has his own comic book. How the times have changed, right? Now, back in Ohio, we're at the Evangeline Motel. Teresa and James rent a room, and they're planning on sneaking the rest of the team in, so they're kind of like stumbling over their story. They know that they're doing something wrong, so it gets kind of weird. The manager, he assures him he does not care. He could not care less. He reminds them that this is a no-tell motel. He's like, do whatever you want, I don't care. He refers to the pair as a married couple. He's like, hey, what married people do is their own business. But Siren takes a weird amount of exception to that. She's like, oh, no, absolutely not, absolutely not. And James calls her out for it, but it gets brushed off. So they rent a room. They sneak out of the office, or they don't sneak out of the office. They just walk out of the office, and then they proceed to sneak the others into the room. And by sneak, I mean they all burst into this tiny motel room with, fanfare. It's like they're lucky they didn't actually come through a wall. Now, there are only two beds, five kids, so they got to figure out the sleeping situation. Danny is only worried about taking a long bath, and she actually starts taking her clothes off right there. She's wearing a thong, just in case you were interested. Worth noting, because they did draw a great amount of detail into showing her off her underwear. Later that night, we see that Tabitha and Danny got the beds, and the rest are bunked out on the floor. Danny, worth noting, is only using like the very edge of her bed. She looks very uncomfortable, which is a neat little touch, considering everything she's been through of late. Tabitha laments the fact that the room doesn't have cable, and she's not talking about the guy. She just really wants to watch Talk Soup, which was one of my favorite shows back in the day as well. I thought that was probably the only way I would watch talk shows was on Talk Soup. That's one of those shows that I wonder how well it might have aged. You know, like if I was able to find some of them on YouTube, would I actually watch them and enjoy them? You know, I remember that was like on E, and I think it was on like 10 o'clock, and it was followed by Nightstand, which was a fake talk show starring the guy who Kramer got off Snickers bars or whatever on Seinfeld. And then it was an hour of Howard Stern, which I loved at the time, but it's one of those things that it's hard to go home to. You know, it's hard to enjoy those so far removed. I don't know. Anyway, James is there reading Fear and Loathing because he's almost as deep as Danny. Bobby asked James to spill the beans about his time in Detroit a little while back. You see, he got wrapped up with the Vanisher and he wound up crossing into another dimension. This was all in service of him learning about that Michael Whitecloud fella and then cracking the code on his family's massacre. Tabitha shudders at hearing the name Vanisher because way back in the day, she got wrapped up with him during the very dull Fallen Angels miniseries, and this actually gets a footnote, which actually kind of surprises me. I didn't know that they would pay any kind of direct people to check out the Fallen Angels thing, which had never been mentioned ever again. Now, he was led to the Vanisher by a cartoon version of a coyote who, I guess, was his childhood pet. He delivers the Vanisher to a dude named Sledge in exchange for White Cloud's whereabouts. Now, that's around the time where he and X-Force crossed paths again, and they learned, he learned that they all walked out on Cable. And James had been away for a little while. He was making time with the former Hellion Risk, which was a story that went on, you know, in my reread of it, it feels like it went on way, way, way too long. But what are you going to do? Now, suddenly, this conversation is disturbed by a loud noise emanating from the parking lot. They all head outside in their skivvies to see some dude getting shoved into a trunk of a car. The heroes beat up the would-be kidnappers, and they even break out their powers to do so. The manager comes stomping out, and he threatens to give them all the boot. Now, the fellow that they saved, he gets out of the trunk, and he hands the manager a C-note, and the manager says, okay, you do whatever you want, I'm done. Now, that fellow also makes X-Force an offer that they can't refuse. He refers to it as a mutually beneficial business arrangement. The mutants all scoff at this guy's naivete, and they tell him that he probably couldn't even afford their services, at which time he opens a briefcase which is loaded, jam-packed with $100 bills. And that is X-Force number 71. And man, I had fun with this one. This is just such a fun era for the team here. Just such a different era than the one that I had left. It's got this like weird dichotomy of still being part of the X family while not being completely tied into everything. It felt like for a little while there, or for a long while there, everything was in service of the next big crossover. And this just felt very, very different from that. And actually, you know, crossovers were kind of out of vogue at this point. So, you know, post-Onslaught and Zero Tolerance, it seemed to go, you know, the books, they were still a family of books, but they kind of went their own way. And I think that was exactly what I needed in order to come back and to fully enjoy these books for what they were. And for the books to actually get their own identity, you know, instead of them just being, you know, like M&Ms, you know, where it's like they're different colors, but they all taste the same. Now they were more like Skittles, where they're different colors and they have different tastes to them as well. So, I really like this era. I wish this era was something that was collected, this road trip era of X-Force. For all I know, it's out there somewhere, but I did a quick search and I couldn't find anything on it. There is an X-Men road trip in book that's out, but I don't believe that that's the same thing as this. You know, from here, X-Force is going to get mixed up with the mob and stuff. We're going to get a lot of answers on the Proud Star family and James's tribe. It's just really, really great era. And if I'm not mistaken, John Francis Moore stays on the book until around the time of Counter-X, at which time the book went completely off the rails. But up to that point, this was probably, I gotta say, it was probably the strongest book in the X-Men line to me. It was probably the one that I most look forward to, which wouldn't have been the case a few years prior. The characters all feel like real kids and not, you know, Cable soldiers. And not only is that a great boon for this era, it also, it makes you reflect on the past eras, and it kind of lifts those up because you can see just how out of character it was in the fact that they were doing what they were doing to please and appease Cable, you know? So you could kind of lampshade a lot of the mischaracterization or just the some of the lack of characterization for some of these characters in those earlier adventures, but just such a strong, strong era that I would recommend to anyone to check out. I want to talk about the art a little bit. Adam Pollina is a guy who I thought we'd be seeing a lot more of. I really love his work. It's kind of, you know, it kind of has like a little bit of a manga flair to it. Not so much like a Joe Majuara, but it's not like the straight 90s comics art that you might be thinking of. He started out very muddy when I think Jeff Loeb was still writing X-Force, and they were using that awful, horrible, slick Marvel Deluxe paper, the X-Men Deluxe paper, where, like, And I've made this comparison before. It's like you feel like you could put your finger in the ink and swirl it around because it's just like laying on top of the paper. It's so thick, so muddy, and just it does no service to the art. It's really, really kind of gross. But after they went back to the more standard sort of kind of thicker newsprint stuff like they've got here, Paulina's art shines. It's really, really good stuff. And again, he's drawing them like real kids. You know, they don't, they're not as exaggerated as you would think of when you think of 90s comics art. They're young adults and they look like young adults. It's really good stuff. Now, one of the things that caught me back then was just how low stakes this all felt. And that's actually it's a really good thing because it allows you the time to buy in. And it's not like, you know, how there was always like, there'd always be like a quiet issue of X-Men or Uncanny X-Men after a crossover event. There'd always be like that downtime issue where everyone would collect their thoughts and they'd have like a, you know, sort of like a day in the life sort of a story. This is like a day in the life arc, and it gives you a lot of time to get to know these characters and understand their interactions and see what they mean to one another. You know, it feels almost like a Marvin George Teen Titans sort of story. So then when something big does happen, something earth-shattering or high stakes does happen, you feel it. You know, it's like you're on that roller coaster rather than just a constant build to, okay, well, when's this next reveal going to be? When is this next crossover going to happen? What books am I going to have to buy from other X-Family books to understand the revelations that are going to come up here? This was all very, you know, inside itself, and just, it's just wonderful. I really, like I said, I wish this was collected in trade so I could just tell you, go get this book, rather than, you know, go to Marvel Digital or Marvel Unlimited and just find these particular issues, which I suppose you could do just as well. But I would definitely recommend checking it out. I was worried going into this one that it wasn't going to age all that well. And outside of some of the, you know, late 90s fashions, which I'm a sucker for anyway, it really, I mean, this was just a smartphone away from being a, you know, a current year story. You know, it's still relevant. It's still fun. And it's aged surprisingly well. That's the writing and the art. I just can't say enough good things about this one. And it just makes me wish I had more time to reread the entire Road Trip arc because I'm gushing at this point, but it's a lot of fun. It really is. And it's a way that shows the strength of having a big family of books, you know. It shows you the opportunities that are there and the potential for things to be different and for all the books to be strong, but in different ways, you know. It's so often now everything is the same or something would be shockingly different just to be shockingly different. This still feels like an X-Men book, but not like X-Men, you know. It's just such a fun era. And I think a lot of people overlook this era because I think a lot of people were like me in that they bailed out before this could happen. If you are looking through back issue bins or anything, this era is some of the harder ones to find because I'm guessing print runs, you know, probably dropped during this time. So these are the ones that are going to give you the trouble to find. They're not going to be worth a whole heck of a lot, but they might be a little bit tougher to track down, at least in my experience. Any books from around 97 to 2000 are the ones that you might have to hit a few shops in order to find, but I promise you, this one is worth tracking down, no matter how you can do it, digital, print, whatever you can do. I would wholeheartedly recommend checking out this era. And I think I'm done rambling and repeating myself over and over and over again for this week. I want to thank you so, so much for hanging out. If you guys have any comments on this era of X-Men or any era of X-Men, or if you want to, you know, talk to me about the actual current X-Men number one that just came out, definitely hit me up. I'm at Ace Comics on Twitter. You can get us on weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. You know, all the websites, all that good stuff. But again, thank you so, so much for hanging out. I'm really having a good time rediscovering all of these wonderful stories and making use of the other half of my collection once again, which is a pretty cool thing to be able to do because I thought it was just going to take up space for the rest of my life. So I really, really appreciate you sticking around and hanging out with me, and I will talk to you again real soon. See ya.